On this episode of This Week in Space, we talk Starship and more Starship. Pros and cons are flooding the Twitterverse. Find out what we think coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 59, recorded on April 28th, 2023, The Battle for Starship.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club TWiT. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club TWiT Discord, a great clubhouse for TWiT listeners. And finally, the TWiT Plus feed, with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled, Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support.
Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space, the Stop Hating on SpaceX edition. I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine, and I'm joined by the impassioned Tarek Malik, editor-in-chief of space.com. Hello, Tarek, and happy birthday, you old man.
Oh, thank you. I'm back. Rod, I'm so glad to be back finally.
Can you share some of your complaints about having to go see the biggest rocket launch in history with our
audience? Oh no, it was so difficult. It was so hot. It was like 80 degrees all day, even at night.
We
had the greatest food in South Texas.
Were there insects the size of your shoes?
No, we're on the beach. Oh darn, again. We're on the beach.
South Padre. You were in South Padre, right?
Yeah, South Padre.
Down in Boca Chica. So I hear it's very pretty there. I actually did some looking because I thought, you know, if you're going to be going to those launches, and I should encourage Ad Astra to send me to some of those launches, for the price of hotels down there when they start kicking up rates because of launches, we should just rent an apartment. And you'll never guess how much a small one-bedroom apartment is in Brownsville.
How much is that?
3 miles away, 3 or 4 miles away, $325 a month.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Which is one night at a hotel. That's not too bad.
I tell you, Brownsville, though, is across the causeway. So it's a little bit further away. Like, you'd have to deal with traffic on the way in. But, you know.
You can't walk 4 miles?
It's a very long bridge, and there is not a crosswalk. across that bridge.
Oh, well, that might be a problem. Okay, we'd have to jump on the back of a car or something. All right, well. Let us move on. Before we begin, however, a new space joke from loyal listener Stuart Sitzman.
Ooh, lay it on me, Stuart.
When the teacher discussed NASA's plans about landings on the moon and Mars, she asked her students if it would be possible to land on the sun. You know where this one's going. One student raised his hand and enthusiastically replied, "Yes, we land at night."
I love it. No.
Took him a second to find the cricket button because he hasn't used it for a while. Okay, that's a variation on jokes we've heard.
I like that one. You know, there is an amazing video with Ollie G interviewing Buzz Aldrin about landing on the sun. And he's like, "Oh, we'll just go at night or we'll go at winter because it's too hot."
And the Ollie G guy, "Yo, Buzz, my man, yo, we're going to land on the sun, right?" And I still, to this day, you know, that was years ago, but by then you'd think that most PR firms would know who and what Ali G was. So Buzz came on there as he will, you know, being open-minded and serious and trying to make sense of talking to this moron, parent moron. And I thought he was a very good sport. There were no fisticuffs or anything, and
he didn't punch someone in the face
very well.
That's always a win, right?
It was Bart. What's his name? I mean, he asked for it. That was a horrible thing that guy did. But still, you know, asking somebody of that stature to sit and listen to this moronic spittle for that long, it just kind of stunned me that he hung in there with it. A and B that his handlers would let that one go by.
Yeah.
Anyway, that said, please don't forget to join Team Tarek, the infamous Team Tarek, and send us your best and worst space jokes. We always love getting them. And don't forget to do us a solid. Make sure to like, subscribe, and all that podcast stuff because we need you to. And now, drum roll on the headlines.
Yes, let's go. I'm all ready for it.
hey, bye-bye Hakuto probe, the former Google Lunar XPRIZE contender, iSpace from Japan, working with a UAE company that made a small rover called Rashid that was on board, had been working for a decade to try and make a privately funded and constructed lunar lander
as part of the Google Lunar X Prize, which, if I remember correctly, was going to pay $30 million for the first private entity to land on the moon and move, what was it, 500 meters?
Yeah, I think it was 500 meters, or you had to take photos from like two different locations.
Yeah.
You didn't have to drive. You just had to like hop or.
You could drive or hop. Yeah. But of course, you know, in this world, $30 million buys you like the first 10% of development for that. Yeah. Anyway, the Google Lunar X Prize closed, I think, in 2017 with no winners, but iSpace forged on and they launched and they left Earth orbit and they got into the lunar sphere of influence and headed down. But unfortunately, as Tarek is going to tell us, they didn't make it to the future, to the surface, at least not transmitting.
Yeah, this was a real sad one because I think it was on my birthday on April 25th. Oh, geez. And so we were really, really rooting for a birthday moon landing. But as you mentioned,
it's iSpace, all about you, isn't it?
I was watching it on like live on YouTube, and the lander Hokuto R, it's called M1, so Mission 1, and it was carrying this UAE moon rover Rashid, but also I believe a JAXA rover as well, a little small one. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea was that they were going to make the first private moon landing ever, right? This has been attempted before. An Israeli commercial probe tried to do it a while ago, also crashed into the moon, and they got really close. You know, the spacecraft itself launched, I believe, on a SpaceX rocket some time ago. It was taking a real slow trip to get to the moon, and it was supposed to land like in the midday of April 25th, and it went behind the far side of the moon, basically, from us, and so they didn't hear from it. And as it came up behind, it was supposed to land, and something happened. It lost contact with the ground as it was supposed to be in like the last few miles on the way down, and they think that may be what did it in. The iSpace founder and CEO Takeshi Hakamada, you know, said that they have to assume that they didn't make it, you know,
right.
Because I think it'd be better to assume that than like the alternative, which would be that they landed successfully and no one will ever know, right? That would be worse. But it was really disappointing because everything seemed to be going well up until that point. They had this list of about 12 different milestones, of which they got through 8 of them. You know, number one is, you know, build the lander. Number two is get off the ground. Number three is, you know, ace your lunar trajectory flight. A lot of steps like that, you know, go into orbit, you know, fire your engine to lower your orbit for landing. They got very close to their target, which was a crater called Atlas Crater. They were going to land on the floor of it. It's about 54 miles wide. It's on the Sea of Cold. And now, sadly, it's a cold grave for the Hokuto order. There is a silver lining.
Well played, sir. Well played.
There is a silver lining. And that lining is that this is not a one-off and done for iSpace. They have already built or started building M2. Right. That's the second one. And so they are definitely going to be combing through as much telemetry as they got from M1 to find out, like, was it the navigation system? Was it something else? Did something fail when it was behind the moon? And they will be incorporating all of that into that mission. The UAE, meanwhile, actually today, right before we started recording, has announced that they will, in fact, be building a Rashid 2, a sequel to the rover that they lost. And whether or not that flies on M2 or a different lander, we don't know. And there are already plans for at least an M3 a lander as well. So iSpace is in it for the long haul. It sounds like this one failure is not going to break the company, which is really, really good because that does show that they've got a pipeline. And NASA and other partners around the world are going to need a lot more ways to get to the moon because they have a lot more rovers, a lot more experiments that they want to deliver. And so they need these commercial landers so that they don't have to build them.
And I think there's actually an M3 because they had issued something saying that they were hoping to fly again in either 25 and 26, right?
Yeah, M2 is 25. M3 was supposed to be 26. They just wanted it to be like a regular pipeline. They seem to have that construction pipeline going right now.
It's interesting. You know, this seems to be the fate of a lot of these smaller landers, whether private or government. So Bereshit, which is the Israeli one that went down it was about 18 months ago now. Also, yeah. As I recall, lost contact shortly before what would have been touchdown. And the Beagle that went down towards Mars, which was from the UK, didn't it also, did they lose contact after it? Speed impact or before?
They actually found it. It actually landed, it appears, okay, but it didn't deploy its solar arrays properly. They think that the airbag might have kind of covered it or whatnot, so they couldn't actually power on and say, hey, look, I'm here. But they have actually seen it, and they were able to spot it after that. It just seems like it's really difficult to make that last mile, you know, on the moon for these probes. But they are startups. You know, one of the things, and we're going to talk about this later, is that these companies can take risks that like NASA and maybe, you know, the other space agencies really can't. Because, you know, NASA launches a lander and they lose it. People question why we're even doing it at all because of the taxpayer kind of angle of it. These companies, you know, they build a product, they test it, they don't make it all the way through. They build a new version of the product. They test it. Maybe they get a little bit closer or they achieve what they need, and then they make it better over time. We've seen that already. We're going to talk about it again with SpaceX, with Falcon 9 rockets now, and now this new Starship. But I think this is another example of that, just a new version for that.
All right. Next up, NASA and Voyager 2. The spacecraft will be extending its interstellar science mission for at least 3 more years. They're using a small technical trick, as they call it, or a hack, to keep the 46-year-old mission going. Just a little bit of background, launched in the late 70s, flew past the outer solar system, then exited, moving beyond the heliopause, which is where the solar wind slows down and you begin feeling the influence of galactic cosmic rays instead. And these things are powered by plutonium pellets that give off heat, and they're wrapped in a thermocouple, which is a bimetallic sort of sheeting that takes that heat and converts it into voltage. Not much. You know, we're talking about enough watts to light your refrigerator if you open the door. But it was enough over the decades. However, plutonium does gradually decay, and more critically, as it turns out, the bimetal sheathing that makes up this thermocouple, this heat power generator, begins to decay because little bits of metal, for processes I don't really understand, begin to, it almost gets like little stalactites that move.
Little fuzzies, yeah.
Metal, yeah. And they begin shorting out that generator. So it becomes less efficient over time. So while in theory, the plutonium should be lasting, I think it's only halfway through its eventual demise, it's the generator itself is starting to have problems. So they're down to, I think, I don't know, what, 5 watts at this point?
Oh yeah, it's something really low. They're on like, it's like life support almost. To keep everything on. You know, this is, I should point out, by the way, this comes from while space.com wrote about these stories. Comes from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is the home base of the Voyager missions. And, you know, to put it in perspective, Voyager 2 has 5 science instruments. And you know, you mentioned it's, you know, 46 years. It's a very, very nice number because, again, Voyager launched when I was born 46 years ago. So that's another way that space is all about me, Rod, just to show you. But so it has 5 instruments, and they were going to have to make some really hard choices because they've been like turning off everything they can, you know, like how on Star Trek, when they like cut all the power to try to, you know, they divert everything to life support. That's what they're doing for Voyager 2 and Voyager 1, where they turn off things like the heater and like this high gain antenna, maybe because they can use the low gain, you know, things like that.
Right.
But mostly like the heaters, the stuff that they could, you know, conceivably live without. But this year they were looking at a really difficult choice because if they want the mission to continue for any number of years longer, they were going to have to turn off a science instrument, which is really, really sad when you think of this as one of only 2 spacecraft in interstellar space right now, the first one ever to get out there. But what they did when they took a really close look at the system is they're like, well, we've got this safety system on Voyager 2. It's a voltage regulator. It's the thing that smooths out that power flow so that there isn't any hiccups that might short out an instrument. And it uses, you know, it has like this little reserve of power that it kind of sets aside for itself. And they said, well, if we turn that regulator off, then we have that power and we can keep these other instruments going for longer, so much so that they can get 3 extra years with all 5 instruments. So instead of starting to shut down this year, they could start to do that process in 2026. And they were able to make that work. Voyager 1 doesn't have to make that decision yet because it already has an instrument that failed earlier on in the mission, which means that it's running on 4 instruments right now. So it has a little bit of a buffer in terms of its power going forward. But now they know that this works. So if you know, they don't have any shorts or any other surprises on the power system with this safety system like off, they know they can do the same thing on Voyager 1 and have a little bit more of a lifetime for that mission too. And it's just kind of a nice surprise to find out something new about your 46-year-old mission out in deep space, because I think it's just a nice little illustration for all of us that we can all learn new things even later in life.
So 46 sounds like a lot of time, but that's about how old you are, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I am like 6 months older than the Voyager mission, you know? So
yeah, well, thank God you're older and not younger. I'd feel terrible if that was the case. And I've mentioned this on the show before, but just in case anybody's wondering, you know, are we spending good money after bad to try and keep Voyager going? If you go visit Voyager Mission Control, it's a small corner now at JPL. It used to be down the street in an old converted insurance office. Now it's back at JPL, but it's basically 2 banquet tables and a couple of Sun workstations and about, I think at this point, 8 people.
Yeah,
some of whom are volunteering, so it's not what you'd call money-intensive mission control. I mean, it basically looks like a couple of people running their ham radio hobby or something. Okay, for story 3, I give you the deck. You have your choice of Deimos or Juice.
I think I'm going to go with Juice. If our listeners might, you know, the United Arab Emirates, their Mars orbiter took an amazing picture of the Mars moon Deimos. I really encourage everyone to go check that out. But I do want to give people a health check on Jupiter's on the European Space Agency's JUICE Jupiter probe, which just launched earlier this month, and everything seemed to be going well. But unfortunately, we got an update actually today as we're recording this that they're having some problems with what they call their RIME antenna. And that's actually an acronym because, you know, we're talking about space. JUICE itself is an acronym for Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer. But the RIME antenna is this 16 meter. So what is that? A little bit more than 50 feet, something like that. Antenna called the Radar for Icy Moons Exploration. And that's a pretty critical piece of hardware for a Jupiter Icy Moons Explorer. It's designed to look beneath the icy shells of these moons, see what's you know going on beneath the surface. A very, very critical piece of hardware, and it's stuck on the spacecraft right now. So they've been trying to figure out why it is kind of jammed against this mounting bracket. They've got video of them trying to like expand it only for it to snap back into place. And so they're hoping to find a solution because, you know, it is something that they really were hoping to get a lot of data about the interior and the subsurface and the surfaces of these moons for the mission. And they've got some time. I mean, they've got a long, long, long cruise out to Jupiter. So, you know, it's possible they could always find a solution between now and then, but they just wanted to give everyone an update. You know, they got a crack team of you know, free RIME scientists trying to desperately get this loose. And we'll keep you updated on how that goes.
And the last thing I saw from them was that they thought a retaining pin was kind of hanging in a semi-dislocated position, which is not where you want it. You want it to be completely pulled out.
Yeah.
And that some knocking it around might knock that loose. And this is not unfamiliar territory. I mean, the same thing hung up Viking 1 seismometer. It had a retaining pin that wouldn't shake. No, it was the arm. Sorry, it was the arm that they couldn't get to operate. That might have been Viking 2. It was one of the Viking landers.
And Galileo's high-gain antenna.
Well, right? I was going to get there, yeah. But they managed to bang the arm around until they got the pin freeze. That worked out well. Galileo, on the other hand, had that antenna that hung up. And boy, the story behind that is just fascinating about the thing being, you know, they were waiting for a build it in the shuttle to launch, and they kept driving it back and forth across the U.S. in and out of storage over to KSC for integration, and then we're not going to launch now, back to storage. And apparently just this antenna unfolded like an umbrella, and between the lubricant aging out and getting thicker, and the little elbows of the antenna struts kind of wearing into position, the thing just, once it launched, didn't open because they unfortunately didn't do a deploy check before they launched. And so they ran that mission off of the low gain antenna, which,
and we didn't get the nice videos of the atmosphere that we had to wait till Juno to get those videos.
Yeah. So. Speaking of Juno, we're going to have Scott Bolton on the show fairly soon. So we'll
be able to
hear the real story from him. All right, let's take a break to meet our sponsors and we'll be right back. All right, let's do a wraparound for SpaceX Starship. So yes. we had Mike on last week, which was great, talking about Starship, and we got to see your launch video with you laughing hysterically as they took off, which was the best part for me.
Yeah, with some. Oh, here it is. Yeah, you talk about the crowd going wild. It was crazy.
With some colorful language, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, when 20 years of space reporting, 20 plus years, you usually watch all of these launches from the press galley, right? Which is just like a very secluded, remote place where it's just a bunch of reporters. And you have some people who are excited. But one of the things that really stood out for this launch was that it was the press section was right there with everybody else. And it was like a carnival, if you will. There was like a music festival where they were playing rock music. SpaceX was playing like 80s greatest hits, you know? and those people were just fired up. There were kids like swimming in the ocean in the morning, which was, I guess the water was warm enough to do that. It was like 80 degrees. It was absolutely, you know, wonderful, a little hazy, but just a wonderful day. And I know I listened to that episode with Mike, and he gave a really good kind of synopsis of what we knew at that point in time. It was still very fresh. We know a little bit more now, but not a lot. And so we're still waiting to kind of find out what the fallout of all of this is. But there's definitely a lot more to kind of dive into for this one, because there's a pretty intense reaction, I think, in the public.
Speaking of fallout, so one of the reasons I wanted to circle back on this was because of the stunningly bizarre public reaction. So we had this test launch. We knew, because Elon had told us, and those of us who have been following this for years knew, you know, this is the first test of the lower stage, which is the scariest part, because that's kind of a moderate yield nuclear warhead worth of energy that's being carried up by that thing. And this different kind of launch platform with the catcher sticks and no flame trenches. So the bunch of things he was doing, as he will, to kind of cut corners, but get the job done. And so the test was partially successful. The booster and Starship, as mated together, cleared the launch tower, which was a big milestone, and did get up to about 24 miles before they began having malfunctions and were affected by engine outs and so forth, and ultimately didn't explode. Popular press, as you keep saying, it was exploded by command from a switch that says blow the rocket so it's not a danger to anybody. But the part that got me was, so we're used to the popular press, the mainstream media saying, oh, rocket blew up, it's a failure. And then we started getting pushback from both the press and the Twitterverse and just people about, well, why are all these SpaceX engineers in these videos cheering after the thing blew up?
Yeah.
They should be sobbing. Yeah. Well, so partly that's coaching, because, you know, there is media coaching at SpaceX as to how to behave when these things go off. So I'm told anyway. But also because it did succeed. It just succeeded partially, but depending on who you talk to, somewhere between 75 and 90%, that's pretty good. And I just want to point out that, you know, as you said earlier, NASA can't afford those explode rockets. Yeah. Set up the SLS, even without a crew, it blows up and Congress starts screaming, oh my God, what's wrong with you guys? We're cutting your funding. And the contractors throw up their hands and say, it wasn't our fault. And the public says, oh, NASA can't keep their job straight, you know?
I'll say this. I actually sat down across the desk from Bill Nelson, a day or two before the early attempts to launch SLS. And I asked him, if it fails, what's next? Like, are you really in it for the long haul? And he gives, you know, the pat answer, you know, right. Yes, of course we're going to do it again, but you know, there's going to be a big reckoning if you spend, according to, you know, in terms of building a giant rocket, 18 years, right. Building a giant rocket, only to have it fail on the first one after it's billions of dollars over budget. It's only been, 7 years since the announcement of Starship,
right.
To this. And it's been, 4 years since the rollout of the first Starship SN1 and the test that we saw there. And, you know, SpaceX leans into these failures to learn.
And excuse me, but let me just say Starship being the top half of the rocket, which is actually the easier part to do because it's only got six engines. It has to do the belly flop maneuver and it has aerodynamic sophistication involved. But when you're talking about the first stage, a super heavy booster with 33 engines, all this plumbing for the fuel to reach these engines, computer controls, they have to check themselves and check with each other. I mean, this is a very sophisticated piece of machinery. And oh, by the way, it's twice as powerful as a Saturn V. That's a big deal.
I want to point out that the video that we're showing right now, that was right there. We just cut away from that was inside the Starship as it's like tumbling in space. You can see it's still pretty stable at that joining bit between Starship and Super Heavy, despite the fact that it's 24 miles up and tumbling around like a rocket should never actually do. They were pretty impressed by that to see how that worked. But, you know, there was a lot of expectation setting by Elon Musk, by SpaceX, that says, you know, chances are it's going to explode. Chances are it's going to fail. But we want to see, you know, if it's ready to go. I mean, very clearly, and I think we're going to talk about this, they made a mistake with the launch pad.
But I want to say something before that. So
yeah, let's talk
about that. That is the crux of this. But, you know, for people who, so I'm not an Elon apologist. He drives me a little crazy. His politics are over the road. You know, he's trying to broker peace around the world. I mean, he does some odd and questionable things. But he does have some brilliance in terms of pushing technology. And I just want to remind people, the only reason we haven't been digested by China in terms of launch rate and accomplishment with that is because of SpaceX. If they hadn't come along and literally revolutionized launching rockets and launching payloads, and we're about neck and neck with China between SpaceX and them, we'd still be depending on the traditional aerospace suppliers at grossly inflated rates and probably have a flight cadence of about 30% of what we do now. Mm-hmm. So that's important to remember. And one more point I want to make is in terms of iterative engineering. So they build stuff, they fly it, it blows up. Oh my God, how could you do that? And yes, we do need to talk about the launch platform because that was a big boo-boo. But in terms of blowing up rockets, he's already got two or three more of these things standing by that are ready to go as soon as he gets clearance from the FAA.
I think a few more than two or three.
Well, finished, I mean, supposedly. But yeah, this is an assembly line. He's the Henry Ford of rocketry. And a bunch of them sitting around that are considered out of date now that probably could be flown, but won't be. So the idea is to try it, see what goes wrong, and then build again. And this is not out of keeping with how NASA and their contractors have done business. It's not what we think of today, but when you go back to the beginning of the space race, when they were figuring stuff out in much the same way Musk is trying to figure out how to do Starship. So let's look at the engines for the first stage of the Saturn V, these great big single chamber F1 engines. There are five of them, but 1.5 million pounds of thrust each. So those are being built by Rocketdyne and they blew up a lot of them. They would do tests on a static tests on a stand and they'd fire it and it would begin vibrating. And the next thing you know, a piece comes off and they either shut it down just in time or kaboom.
I missed a pile.
And they,
I normally wouldn't do this, but I got to cut in on the show here.
It's Ant. It's Ant.
Wow.
Yeah, it's Ant. I'm technical director for This Week in Space. But so
and a user of Athletic Greens. Yes, go ahead.
So you're saying that this was basically like a remote detonation, the explosion that we saw? This was done by team at SpaceX. Yet everything that I read and every headline that I saw was it exploded. So this was
this is my design.
This is the press.
That has a great question. We should define, Rod, what a flight termination system is. So go ahead.
Please go.
Okay. Yeah. So, Ant, this rocket has, most rockets have a flight termination system. It's basically a safety system that says the rocket goes out of control. We're going to either program it so that it knows that it's out of control and it'll blow itself up over the ocean, or we're going to command it from launch control to blow itself up. That way it doesn't like spin around and then come back and end up crashing into Brownsville or South Padre Island that way. So that's what this rocket was equipped with. And when it got to a point where it did not stage properly, that's the explosion that we've been showing in the video, that system kicked in. I believe it was autonomous, according to the FAA's statement, that the autonomous system kicked in. But SpaceX would have likely pushed a button just to be sure as well. One way or another, that system intentionally destroyed the rocket at a point where it was clear that it was not going to, it wasn't flying according to plan. So the explosion itself wasn't intentional. It probably would have exploded anyway, eventually, but they wanted to make sure that they could control where it exploded. And that's what that system is.
So, well, let me say this, because if this was by design,
My show's been hijacked.
I need to give kudos to you all, because you're putting the information out there that should be there, unlike what mainstream media is not doing. So the FAA was involved and knew all of this as well. So it's a credit to you all, because, again, all I've ever seen was just people trying to poo-poo on SpaceX and Elon Musk. And that's just wrong. And that's just craptastic journalism. Okay, I'm cutting my mic off. I'm sorry.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, Ant Pruitt, our technical director and co-producer, who thinks that sports are more important than space, but we forgive him that every week when we have him on the show.
Wait till we get sports in space.
And he does, what is it, Ant? 500 push-ups a day?
No, I used to do about 400. I'm probably down about 2 now.
Okay, well, I want you to remember, when you finally get your chance to fly on a rocket someday, that there will be a flight termination system there, and I could be sitting by the button, so be nice.
There's one on the Falcon 9. There's one on the Falcon Heavy. There's one on the on almost every rocket that launches. You know,
Saturn V's that were launching crews to the moon had them, but you would abort first.
And they have launch abort systems like SpaceX's crew flights have to pull the capsule free. That's another thing we haven't talked about: escape systems for Starship, and there isn't one. And so that is something that we're going to have to talk about eventually.
Well, we may have to have a third episode sometime. Yeah. I just want to finish my previous thought, which is, so when they're developing these engines, the Saturn V, they would blow up, and then the engineers would go out and collect the pieces and look at them and pull out their slide rules and their pencils and their pads, do some calculations, build it, and blow it again. I have seen varying accounts of how many exploded, but it was not an insubstantial number, and it was a very expensive way to do business. And they finally solved the problem, which was uneven burning of the fuel in the combustion chamber, by actually setting off an explosion in the engine when it was starting to run up to speed, and therefore they controlled the acoustic vibrations and blah, blah, blah. So what Musk is doing is not terribly dissimilar. You know, he's testing these things to either destruction or success, and that's how you learn. What you don't want to do, however, is hurt anybody or have too big an impact on the community when you're doing it. And that is the problem with the much discussed launch platform. And you were there, Tarek, so why don't you go ahead and take that?
To talk about the launch, you mean the launch pad itself?
I assume once the thing was up and you were done tracking it up to the point that it destructed, when you looked down, you probably saw a big mushroom cloud coming out of the launch area, right?
I can talk about, you know, the launch, when we watched it take off, a liftoff, we're about 5 miles away from the pad, across like a waterway from Boca Chica Beach. So it's very picturesque. And because of the way they built the launch pad, when those 30 engines ignited, they started just immediately carving out a massive crater underneath the pad, the way they built the pad. And it kicked up a huge amount of debris to us.
Excuse me. Can I just jump in for a second? So the pad looks like a milk stool sitting over a flat body of concrete. And normally the way NASA and other nations have done rocket launches, you have a flame trench that ducts the exhaust down and away from that area. And sometimes a water suppression system, which floods that area with water to keep the acoustic waves were coming back and slamming in the bottom of the rocket. SpaceX did neither of those. They cast a big flat piece of concrete and said, well, that'll probably work.
Yeah. And it's a little, it's pretty difficult to dig a really deep flame trench with the water table so high,
right,
on the beach there too. And in 2020, Elon Musk sent out a tweet saying that they were looking at not having a flame, diverter, at the pad, and that they think, you know, they're hoping for success, but it could end up being a big mistake. From the spectator point of view, it was spectacular because you get to zero, you see this initial flash of the engines, and you don't hear anything because it's, you know, far away and the sound hasn't reached you yet. And then you see this massive plume of exhaust around, like you would see for any big launch, but it just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and it swallows up the whole rocket. And this is a 40-story tall rocket, right? It's the size of a skyscraper. And so then you can't see anything anymore. And no one knows what's going on. Did it abort? You know, did it fail? They clearly didn't explode because we would have seen that. And then very, very slowly, like mind-numbingly slowly, you start to see the rocket lift off. And that's when everyone just lost their minds in the video that I shared. And it was spectacular to see. It was only later that when we saw those close-up images of the pad. In fact, there's RVG aerial photography recently did a pass over the pad, and they got really close pictures of what it looks like now. Or if you see the drone video flying off to the side, you can see offshore these massive splashes in the ocean where the debris, chunks of concrete, and you can actually see it in the close-up videos in SpaceX's own video. You can see huge pieces of concrete flying up halfway up the rocket. Again, that's 20 stories. That's 200 feet. You know that it's flying up. So that's what we saw there after the fact. So was it a mistake? I think Elon Musk would say yes. You know, he said that it could be a mistake. Now it was. They're planning to do what they called a water-cooled steel plate beneath the pad itself. I'm not sure what that looks like, if it's like shaped in a way to angle the plume and the sound away or not. After you and Mike spoke last week, last episode, Elon came out and said, well, we think that we can get the pad fixed in 1 to 2 months, which sounds extremely ambitious to get this stuff done. But, you know, it's possible that they can use a lot of the structure that's still there. The milk stool is still there. The concrete is still there. The tower, the giant Mechzilla tower with those little chopstick, you know, levers that move the starship around, the arms that move the starship around. It's all still there, and it appears to be in working order. But there's a lot of other things that have to get fixed. Well, clearly the crater beneath the pad. And I'm not sure if you've seen the other photos or if our listeners have
seen. Well, we have those on, in case Ant's here, we have those on lines 37 and 38 of the rundown.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's clear dents and dings, like very visible in the tank farm feeds,
which is
the rocket.
Too close.
Oh, it's really
way too close. I know they only had so much property, but the stuff and the other starships kind of stacked up nearby. If I had seen that in a science fiction illustration as a kid, I would have gone, those things are too close together. They're going to blow up.
So you can see right here, it's like the engines fired 7.7 million pounds of thrust from the super heavy booster, just like digging a hole.
17 million pounds. Yeah.
So.
I'm
thinking about the propellant capacity.
There is some conversation about, you know, what damaged the engines of the 33 engines on the first stage, of which somewhere between 5 and 8 failed, depending on who you're listening to and what phase of the flight you're talking about. Because I guess a couple of them sputtered as the rocket's ascending. You could see these little blips of yellow and orange flame that you're not supposed to be seeing from that, at least not as intensely as that, that look like hydraulic fluid burning or something. So, of course, there's all kinds of conjecture. Getting news out of SpaceX takes a lot of patience, so we don't know yet. But I think it's safe to say, and by the way, a couple of very smart people, including Dwayne Day, who I follow, who's a heavy-duty space guy, had noted that it looks like some of the nozzles might have even been knocked off. And when you think about what was going on that launch pad for the many seconds it took it to lift off, all kinds of things could happen. What didn't happen, thank God, is it didn't sit there long enough. I mean, you saw how the bottom of that one leg is completely eroded out from the flames. I wonder, had that thing begin to lose structural integrity, the launch stand itself, and begin to topple, I mean, if you have a rocket tipping over and going kaboom or heading off in the wrong direction, as our model rockets used to do a lot, even a flight termination system isn't going to save the damage on the ground. So that would have been very bad. And that's the one place that I think, you know, as has been happening, where they deserve some criticism for perhaps rushing this or cutting a few too many corners with this launch system. So if there's a failure in this whole test, I would say, besides perhaps the foresight to see what could have happened here, it could be credibility. You know, we're already seeing some concerns about SpaceX in terms of this test, even though it was partially successful. Given that the FAA now has to do an investigation, God knows how long that'll take, and SpaceX has to repair that pad and all the other things that have to happen, you know, we're counting down to this version of this spacecraft being the lander for the Artemis 3 mission, which is supposed to be snicker snicker in 2 years. We know it's going to be longer than that, but, you know, the clock is ticking. And I think there's a real danger of people losing confidence in the company because of events like this. What do you think?
The credibility issue, I think, is going to be really, really important. Now, I do believe that SpaceX really set expectations very low on the public side for this.
They tried to.
They did try to.
But do people listen to that necessarily?
Well, there's that. And I think we can all agree. We saw the video. We saw that kind of walkthrough of the pad and the damage that's there. You can see the dented tanks. You can see the debris strewn all around. So that's a hit to like what the success of this is. However, actually, just a day before this episode that we're recording, NASA's chief was asked specifically like how realistic is getting to the moon in 2025 going to be when the giant rocket that's going to carry the lander just blew up? And Bill Nelson, the NASA chief, said, you know, that they're not over concerned. He said, and I quote, "It's not a downturn for SpaceX because they are quote unquote hardware rich." And this is to the point that you were mentioning earlier. They have this rocket. This rocket garden at Starbase that has at least three, if not four, near finished or in under construction starships. There's at least one booster, the booster 8, out, like standing up there, the next one to fly, standing up there, ready to go. That they were going to put some more advancements on, and there's another one that they're nearly finished with in the kind of, they have like a couple of VABs. Already that have other vehicles in them as well. They've got a lot of stuff to work with there. So all that's really holding them up is whatever they need to do with this pad and the results from their own internal mishap investigation, which, you know, there's a SpaceX team working on it. And then, of course, the FAA's investigation, which they announced shortly after the Starship launch, that they're going to have an anomaly investigation. They're going to look into it. They'll work with SpaceX. There's debris all over. A lot of it was washing up over the evening. I was walking on the beach at 11 o'clock at night on South Padre Island, and I ran into some SpaceX fans who were out there hoping to see a little bit of flotsam from Starship and maybe take it home as a souvenir. We came up empty handed, but you know, a lot of others did not, from some of the stuff that I saw on social media. And so it'll be a bit of a wait and see to see if it what those recommendations are going to be. The FAA gave SpaceX a launch license for 5 years for this flight test. And one of my big questions is, does that license pertain to another test, or do they have to get a new one based on what happened with the debris that they saw here? Do they have to move back the safe viewing area? Do they have to have some kind of debris mitigation and recovery plan in place that wasn't in plan for this one? That could add extra time.
Well, you don't want to be pulling that debris out of people's skulls, which is a concern after what we saw. So one of the things that I have been trying to research and have only come up with some answers is exactly how that separation maneuver is supposed to work. Now, on the Falcon 9, Elon is famously not in favor of using pyrotechnics, which most other rockets use to separate stages. You blow small explosive bolts and the stages come apart. And in fact, that was actually what held the shuttle down on the launch pad, was big explosive nuts in that case. That, you know, they're
frangible bolts. Is that what
frangible nuts? Frangible bolts. Yeah, these things are like a foot across. And they've got a 70-year history of working well, but they don't enhance reusability. So it makes sense to use hydraulics, which I think is hydraulics and pneumatics, which I think was what he was using on Falcon 9. I had thought I read that Starship was doing the same thing, but apparently, whether they are or not, part of the separation maneuver is the flip. Is that
what you're understanding? They flip the stack over, and then they do a separation so that the booster can get free of Starship, and I guess far enough so that they can ignite the engines on Starship itself. It's still, I have to admit to this too, I'm still a little confused on the physics on how all of that works, right, too, for Starship to then get clear of the booster. I think there was a lot of confusion during the failure for that, because we were all looking for a flip, and when it began to tumble, it was tumbling at the time that we were expecting a flip maneuver. And so that added at least some confusion among some of the spectators there, because we were expecting to see it move around, and then we did in fact see it move around. Then it began to yaw and whatnot.
Right.
It was clearly not optimal. And so we knew, it was clear that there was an issue there. But I would like to see like a little bit more of how that maneuver is really supposed to work, because it seems extremely dynamic on the boosters and Starship itself. But they may just be playing on the physics of the rocket. You know, the Booster 7 is a lot bigger than Starship. If they do that flip, they do that separation, it may just pull away faster because it's so much bigger with Starship, you know, still continuing its ascent on the way back.
All right. Well, let's, in a moment, let's venture into the Twitterverse / Facebookverse / other social media verse and look at some of the impressions that have been prevailing there as soon as we hear from our sponsors. So I'm sure you and I have been reading a lot of the same stuff. I did listen to that podcast that you were supposed to be on yesterday, all 2.5 hours of it. And, you know, there's a lot of opinions flying around. There's a lot of armchair rocket engineers out there saying, I know what's wrong. One of the things I read was that they thought the separation maneuver didn't succeed because they still were too fuel heavy because of the engines that were out. Who knows? But I got a couple of comments I pulled here that I was going to read. I paraphrased most of them. And Tarek, you give me your reactions. So one said, this is what happens to your launch pad when you think it would be funny to launch the world's largest rocket on 420 instead of when it's ready. It will probably be at least a year before the FAA will approve another Starship launch. That's a point.
It's fair. I would point out that they tried to launch the rocket on Monday the 17th, so they weren't really aiming for the 20. That's like a meme that, you know, Elon Musk has leaned into, you know, in the past with jokes. He even made a joke about that for this one. I saw a great headline by Marina Corin of The Atlantic, and it was SpaceX's big rocket gets lit, has bad trip. And I just thought it was hilarious. Oh. So kudos and hats off to her and the Atlantic team, because they really just hit the nail on this argument. I don't think that SpaceX would launch a multi, you know, billion dollar investment, which is what the Starship program is. If they had any serious questions that it was going to truly be a disastrous, you know, event, you know, just because of a date. They've got government contracts, they've got private contracts all riding on this. But at the same time, they do need to learn about the rocket. And if they think they've crossed all of the T's and dotted the I's, then they're gonna go ahead and try and launch. That's how SpaceX lost three Falcon 1s before the fourth Falcon 1 got off the ground. It's how they crashed. How many Falcon 9 first stages before right. they finally got one on the ground?
I think it was almost 20.
Yeah, it was a lot. And now, I mean, we've seen how many SpaceX launches this week alone. I think two, three, maybe three. Starlink. Starlink. We've got a Falcon Heavy launch later today too. We've got two launches today. By the way, they're launching two rockets today as we're recording this. So.
Well, and again, that goes to the point of you know, you're talking about a person, love him or hate him, who has virtually revolutionized rockets, both launching them, recovering them, reuse. I mean, the list goes on. And the cadence is just remarkable. And the guys in other companies, we won't mention names, but, you know, Launch Alliance and so forth, can only look on and envy and shake their heads at what this guy's achieved. And much of what was done with the Falcon 9 was his money. All of what's going on with Starship, except for the little bits of contracts that they're getting in advance from NASA for the lunar part of it, well, is money. Yeah. So, you know, he gets to play it his way as long as he doesn't go against local and national laws.
You know, so that came up in the budget discussion with Bill Nelson yesterday. You know, I was asked this question, how much did NASA just lose on this test flight? Well, the answer is, you know, they didn't lose anything because NASA is buying the landing, you know, the lander flight on Artemis 3. They haven't spent that money yet. You know, they're budgeting to spend that money. They might be, you know, spending on that mission in particular, but they're not paying extra for all this other development stuff. They're getting SpaceX and Elon are getting that money from somewhere else, from the reserved flights with Polaris Dawn on the first crewed flight with Jared Isaacman, who was in that.
And from his bank account.
Yeah.
Let me read a couple more of these before we have to wrap. Another one, Musk is a hero for pushing the state of the art. Well, we've kind of argued that case. I don't know how her. I mean, this hero has a lot of people helping him do this. Notably, people like Gwynne Shotwell, his president at SpaceX, who is
the really engineers person. There. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they keep the assembly lines going. They keep refining the design. He's the boss, but he's got a lot of extremely brilliant, capable people working.
And dedicated people working long hours, you know,
very long hours
on a singular mission to get this stuff done.
Okay, here's another one. Elon's spaceship will fail, ruining NASA. SpaceX is done. I wouldn't count those chickens before they hatch.
I used to be very, I believe it when I see it with SpaceX. And then they started landing rockets left, right, and center. And so now it's like, if they say they're going to do it, I think they're going to do it eventually. And, you know, maybe not on the timetable, you know, that Elon may say, but I mean, eventually they're going to get there. Because of the talented people that they've got behind them.
I'd say if you're dealing with a bookie in Vegas, you could bet against SpaceX in terms of Elon's optimistic timetables. But in terms of betting against them accomplishing what they've set out to do, those are bad odds.
Yep.
Here's another one. I am still in shock that a rocket system, the largest in history, will be fired off from an inadequate facility in the middle of an endangered species habitat. Well, what part of the United States is not considered that? By a company that revels in the beautiful failure of explosions with seemingly no guardrails, no respect for the real danger this operation presents to the public.
That's a lot. Well, there's a lot there.
There's a lot to pick apart there, but basically they're saying that he doesn't take people or animals into consideration and wasn't prepared. And, you know, you can understand where people would get parts of that impression. The endangered species conversation is a difficult one because there are some unique animals and environments there. But then you get down to when you're talking about, and I know I'm going to step in it here a little bit, when you're talking about a civilization shaping program that could change everything from how we move people into space and in what numbers to perhaps building out space solar power, which then reduces our carbon footprint potentially in almost nothing. You know, this is a big deal. And if we crush a few crawdads on the way, how serious is that?
Ooh, that's harsh.
It is, you know, I am not tone deaf to the problems here. It's just, where do you place the red lines here?
It's difficult, right? Because I mean, even Kennedy Space Center is in the middle of Merritt Island Wildlife Refuge, right?
Right.
A
lot of gators out there.
The Wallops Flight Facility is on the Assateague National Seashore. You know, there's a history that's been vetted with all of this in the past, and they are trade-offs. That's why there's an FAA, an Environmental Protection Agency, you know, a wildlife agency that they have to file a lot of things with. And I think that they're all looking, you know, twice now that they see how what the effects of the rocket have been. They'll look at that. They might have some mitigation things. The FAA has already done that once with SpaceX in order to do this flight test. And SpaceX will either, you know, meet that, or they'll pick a different place. I don't think you'll see NASA tell SpaceX they can launch from Pad 39A with the design that they showed for this one. But they'll figure something out. But it is a valid argument that the nature versus space stuff. And as long as, you know, the regulations that oversee a lot of this stuff are adhered to, then then they're following those rules.
Just a small point that's kind of tangential to this, but here we are in the United States, especially on the floors of Congress, trying to keep up with / stay slightly ahead of China, who is at this point perceived, for better or worse, to be our primary adversary in space, whether it's talk about national pride or national security. Both are
also came up in the congressional hearing yesterday. Yes.
Yeah. And you're talking about a country with a grossly lower cost of labor, with a whole different approach to human rights and environmentalism and so forth. Not that they don't do it. It's just very different than what we're used to here. But if you want to keep some kind of cadence, it's going to work. I'm not sure you can protect everything just the way you want. And my apologies for this in advance to the people of Boca Chica, because I'm sure it was a shock to go to bed one night thinking, hey, they're going to launch this little Falcon 9 rocket out of here, and wake up the next morning and discover, oh, they're actually talking about the biggest rocket in history by 200%. That is something that people were concerned about and are concerned about, and after yesterday are probably more concerned about. So, you know, is there another place for them to go launch from that has fewer people and doesn't have these issues? No, you got to be on the coast near the equator, and that's just how it is. So unless he goes out to some mid-Pacific atoll, we're sort of stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you build yourself, they were going to launch on and land on oil rigs for a while. Mm-hmm. And then they abandoned that plan too. But then you have the same problems, except you're out in the open ocean at that point. You know, it affects the ocean at that point too. So,
yeah. And you've got sea state to worry about, and storms, and, you know, early famously.
I was going to say something about China too, because you mentioned it, right? And it is an argument. Oh, we have to keep doing this stuff for China. China has unveiled this week plans for their Long March 9 rocket, which they just announced now will be fully reusable. And they announced new renderings of it, and it looks exactly like Starship. I mean, from the tip down. And so it just goes to show you that it's going both ways, right?
Wait a minute. The intellectual property is only going one way.
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean like the there's a lot of sword saber rattling and hand waving about China is ahead. And what that unveiling showed to me, at least, is that they're not, whether or not you think that they're ahead or not, they're clearly looking to what is being done in the United States and saying, okay, they're doing this, so we're going to unveil that. And so that's, you know, so that the perceived competition is going all the way around. And so if they don't invest in it here, China might just show that they can get it done. I don't know if they can or not, because Elon's got a lot, SpaceX has a lot of really specific experience with this stuff, and they're just showing, you know, PowerPoint stuff right now.
Or if I may have a hawk moment, if we don't innovate it here, China might have to do it themselves, and that would take them an awful lot longer if they can't appropriate intellectual property. All right, let's summarize here. Do you mind if I go first?
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead.
So, if not for SpaceX, we would likely be at this point at least in some regards, a second-class space power, certainly in terms of launch cadence. And even Russia, you know, as you saw, for the 10 years after the shuttle was shut down, we were hitching rides with the Russians and the Soyuz at ever-increasing expense. So between China and Russia, for better or worse, we would have definitely slid into second place. The other thing I want to say is, with regard to Musk, don't confuse the man with the mission.
Yes.
And the company with the mission. SpaceX has a lot of talent, as we discussed. There's lots of people there making great strides and great change for the benefit of everybody, really. And I just want to close with, you know, there's a body of theory around the great man syndrome, you know. And there are people that are going to say, wow, he is the greatest. And others are going to say, what are you talking about? But the bottom line is, if somebody like Henry Ford were around today and doing what he did, I mean, he was a brilliant man. He revolutionized the assembly of automobiles and really industrial processes in general. And he was kind of a jerk. And there's a lot of reasons people wouldn't have liked him. He was anti-Semitic. He hated unions. He wasn't nice to children and kittens and puppies. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons, just like Henry Ford. Thomas Edison, he was a crook. He stole intellectual property right and left. He achieved great things, but he was not a nice guy. So my point here, with the exception of my favorite Albert Einstein and perhaps Carl Sagan, you know, great people are not always nice people, but that should not necessarily subtract from how we perceive their accomplishments. And I think this is just something to bear in mind as it moves ahead. Leave the man, the media image, Twitter, all that stuff out of it. And just cross our fingers that he can achieve, with minimal damage to places like Boca Chica, that he can achieve what he set out to do. Because if not him, then who? Nobody else in modern history could have pulled this off. Jeff Bezos, who I admire in some ways, has been working on this longer than SpaceX. It's been 22 years since Blue Origin started, and they still haven't launched a large rocket. And their engines are still in development. So they've been delivered, but there's still some concerns about them. So let's take a moment and just respect Musk for what he's been able to do.
Yeah, I would hear your comments there, Rod. And I would just say, you know, that when I would advise everyone listening and watching to come at it with a little bit of perspective, because perspective is really key. Now, your point about separating like the man from the mission is really key, because there's a lot of popular opinions and desires to jump on and to yes and to pile on when they see a billionaire, you know, perceivably failed because the rocket didn't achieve the initial mission, and is in the news for a lot of other things. You mentioned Twitter. There's a lot of other things going on. There's Tesla, there's whatever, you know, and there's lots of reasons that a lot of people might not like a certain person for, you know, for different types of causes. But this mission itself is separate than that. And there is a reason why a few years ago, the Vice President of the United States, Mike Pence at that time, you know, said, we need to get to the moon. We need to get there at a certain time. And they're going to get there by any means necessary, you know, and that was because at that time, the only company that was really delivering things on time and pushing boundaries was SpaceX, with the fact that they were scaling up their reusability, their landing and whatnot. And meanwhile, the SLS was behind schedule, was over budget, and only looked like it was going to get more so. You saw a galvanization amongst all quarters to try to make that mission happen like it did. And it went off fairly well. When the motivation is there, then the vehicles, the technology, the innovation is achieved. And the driving force to that has really been a lot of the new things that we're seeing come out of these companies. And they're not all going to work on the first try. SpaceX almost failed in the early days because their first rocket kept failing, you know, once, twice, three times. Elon has said that if they had failed that fourth time, that would have been it for the company. And yet they were able to make that work. They were able to make the reusability work. We saw a rocket make its 13th flight this week alone. And they've already flown rockets 15 different times,
right?
You know,
which we used to just throw away.
Yeah, and we used to just, and we expect it now, You know, yeah, we expect that it to come back, and it's weird when it doesn't. The next Falcon Heavy is going to launch, and we're not going to see the triple landing because the payloads are too heavy. They're going to maximize it. And that's weird now to me, right, that we're not going to see the rockets come back, you know? Right. And so just keep a little bit of perspective. This is a brand new rocket. Not only, I mean, it's not like SLS, which has a core stage derived from the shuttle external tank, which has engines literally ripped off the back end of the space shuttle. It has an upper stage engine on Orion that was pulled from the Ohms engine of a space shuttle. It's not a Frankenstein rocket that we've just taken and like put new bits on. It's new engines, new boosters, new technologies. You know, it's a stainless steel, right? So there are going to be hiccups, big ones, to be sure, right? That have to be worked out. But I think that people should have the perspective to know that test flights mean failures, that test flights mean learning about how a thing works. But test flights also mean more test flights. And this is the last thing I'm going to say, is that this is not a one and done test flight. It's not the end of that program. SpaceX has not just more hardware, they have a lot of different types of test flights to fly. They have to, you know, get this suborbital one done. They have to get an orbital flight done. They have to get the Starship landings done. They have to get Starship in space fueling done. They have to get lunar landing simulations done. They have to get a life support system done. Lots of different test flights are coming for this. And each one of those is going to dictate what the next step is going to be, not just for SpaceX, not just for NASA, but for that industry overall, because everyone else is watching this vehicle to see what they can learn and maybe what they can do in their own vehicles.
Or what they can borrow for their own.
Or what they can borrow. And so it's going to be an iterative stepping stone approach. Is it going to go as fast as Elon says? I can assure you it will not. But it is going to go in some shape or form. And I think it's really exciting to see that. I think that you're going to see a new space industry develop in terms of like spectators and tourism in South Texas, more so than the RD is. And Rod, even if they're not launching from Boca Chica in the near term, once they stack a rocket up there to do some more tests, I encourage everyone to go out there and see it, because it's the only place I've ever been on this planet and in this industry in 20 years where you can be across the street, literally separated by just a few white cones, you know, plastic cones, traffic cones, from the biggest rocket on the planet. And it's just something to see. So that's my last two sit.
Oh, good. Okay. So we'll split expenses for the next trip. And I think most importantly, we got to figure out a way to get our good friend Ant Pruitt on one of these test flights, because I want to see him do push-ups under 5 G's of acceleration. I think that would be very cool.
I bet he can do it.
I bet he can.
Challenge accepted.
You've seen the guy in a t-shirt. You know what I'm talking about. Well, I want to thank everybody for joining us today for our He Said, She Said soft parts to the wall session on the test flight of Starship. Feel free to write us with your opinions. You don't have to agree with us. And you know, if we get enough comments or questions, we'll do this episode again with refreshed content. Tarek, where can we find your very own Mission Control?
Well, you can find me at space.com as always, and of course on Twitter at Tarek J. Malik. I did lose my blue check mark last week, like a lot of other people. So I has the sad. And this weekend you will see me in the audience watching my daughter in Legally Blonde, the musical, Junior. So I'm very excited about that.
I had to sit through a performance of that a couple of years ago because a friend's daughter was in it singing a heart out. She was a lovely singer, but... Wow. Okay. Well, and of course, you can always find me at pilebooks.com and at astromagazine.com. Don't forget to drop us a line at twis@twit.tv. That's twis@twit.tv. We welcome your comments, suggestions, and ideas. And also, don't forget to check out space.com, the website's in the name, the National Space Society at nss.org, and at astromagazine at astromagazine.org. We cover SpaceX in great depth. And I'm talking 4,000 word articles here, and NewSpace as well in Ad Astra, primarily put in by our amazing contributing editor, John Cross. So if you get a chance, you can still get a complimentary issue of Ad Astra off the website, adastramagazine.com. And we do every quarter at least one article on this. Our most recent were how SpaceX is going to contribute to accomplishing the moon landing and orbital fuel depots and tankers. So interesting stuff there. New episodes of this podcast publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher. So make sure to subscribe, tell your friends, give us reviews. 5 stars or a thumbs up will make us happy. And you can head to our website at twit.tv/twists. Finally, don't forget you can get all the great programming on the Twit Network ad-free on Club Twit, as well as some extras that are only available there, including outtakes from our show. Those are always amusing. For just $7 a month, it's a bargain you can't pass up. And you can follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter and on Facebook and twit.tv and Instagram. See you next time.
It's midweek, and you really want to know even more about the world of technology. So you should check out Tech News Weekly, the show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news.
It's the biggest news. We talk with the people writing the stories that you're probably reading. We also talk between ourselves about the stories that are getting us even more excited about tech news this week.
So if you're excited, well, then join us. Head to twit.tv/TNW to subscribe.